So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Matt Deegan. On the show today, is Paul Dacre really going to be running Ofcom? That's the question the sector's asking this week. We'll tell you why. Also on the programme, ITV bounced back with revenues up on the before times. The BBC's under scrutiny as it ends its partnership with Stonewall. And in the media quiz, we learn a novel way to get your outstanding invoices paid. That's all coming up in this edition of the Media Podcast. And joining me today is the MD of TV Indie Gold Waller. It's Faraz Osman.
Hello, Matt. How are you in your new hot seat? This is the first time I've been on this pod with you front and centre.
Thank you very much. Yes, I'm very good. Locked in my little audio box. But I believe that congratulations are in order.
Yeah, we won a Japan award for preschool education for our show What's On Your Head. Yesterday, actually. It's hot off the press. So, yeah, I had a very nice sushi lunch to celebrate. It was delicious.
And did I suppose you couldn't get to Japan, so did they dial you in?
I mean, I'm not saying that I'm slightly bitter about that, but yes, it was very much a Zoom flight to Tokyo. It's one of the places I've always wanted to be, but never actually managed to get to. So who knows? Maybe we'll be extended an invitation for the next season.
Next year. Making his Media Podcast debut, it's the EVP of TV consultancy 3Vision, Jack Davidson. Hello, Jack.
Hi, Matt. It's great to be here.
Good to have you here. So you've been doing some research recently on the streaming wars. Have you got any top data to titillate our listeners?
I just noticed Disney's results came out today, which are not so good, and their story is just, well, maybe a sign of momentum being lost after a fairly strong start. We are, yeah, as you say, we're always covering the streaming wars, and it is a fascinating time, definitely. Obviously, it's competitive, but how the different studios and the different global players are kind of navigating this more competitive environment. I think one of the things I find most fascinating is it almost seems now that the US studio's success depends on what happens everywhere outside of the US, which is a complete reversal of how their fortunes always used to fare before, when they were sort of totally kind of dependent on the networks at home and the domestic market.
Yeah, and there's a real change, I suppose, with launching their own services, partnering on launching services, which I think is what Comcast has done in a lot of European markets, or just selling their stuff to channels like the old days.
Absolutely, entirely. I mean, I think the early sort of period of the global launches, people skimmed over the kind of more complicated side of the issue of launching things globally, such as kind of NBC's significant interest in Sky, in Sky markets, such as kind of Warner Media's long-running HBO output deals that go to 2025 and are worth a lot of money. Kind of those issues are having to be addressed now. And I think kind of not just actually that joint venture, Sky Showtime that NBC and Viacom CBS launched, but how that also all of their activity that fits together. So the Viacom kind of CBS venture Paramount Plus is going to be part of Sky in the UK, but in non-Sky markets it will be part of Sky Showtime, and then likewise, kind of, although not tied, kind of channel carriage deals have been done at similar times. So all of these things are happening that are kind of revealing kind of the more detailed complex aspect of what otherwise they used to call kind of a global streaming rollout.
I'm sure there is a big spreadsheet that you guys have to keep track of all these things. Someone probably not known for spreadsheets, Paul Dacre, a former editor-in-chief of the Daily Mail. Could he really end up as the chair of Ofcom? That's the question many in the sector are now asking, as leaks indicate an interview panel with a sizable Conservative leading contingent. According to The Guardian, the latest panel member is Michael Simmons, who worked as an advisor to Conservative ministers during the 1990s before co-founding the polling company Populous. As a quick reminder, Dacre was interviewed for the role earlier this year and he failed the final interview. The job was then re-advertised by the government, and he's expected to reapply and is seen to be the top choice for the government. Faraz, can you explain why this pairing of Ofcom and Dacre is hard for us to get our heads around, but government seem to really do have him in mind?
So Ofcom is a regulator, and I think that in our, as people that have it drilled into us around impartiality and what we expect the media in this country to do, particularly because I would argue that our television and broadcasting media in this country is so healthy because it is meant to be unbiased from political persuasion. To have somebody come in who is so clearly both from a newspaper space, which doesn't have the same rules about impartiality as a broadcasting space, and has a clear political slant to who it is that supports the current government that's in power at the moment, there are a lot of question marks about the reasoning as to why he's the best person for the job. And is it because he has the best political view for the job, or is it because he is legitimately the best person to be chairing this very important regulator? So I think that that's the question marks that are being held. And obviously, a lot of what Ofcom does regulates the BBC, and that's a kind of big part of what we're looking at here. And as we continue to have question marks around what is unpolitely called the culture wars, and this government's insistence on stoking those, is what it seems. This seems to be another strike across that belt, assuming that he gets the job. It is a very odd recruitment process that you would have somebody that wasn't fit for the job, seemingly in a previous instance, and then that process is rerun with different people making that decision. And there's a general concern that this was a foregone conclusion before it even started. And I have to say, with the recent scandals that have been going through the government, with Owen Paterson and how that's all kind of played out, it does feel like this is one of those things where it's going to be interesting to see how far this government can push to continue to rewrite the rules in their favour. And this may be the next shock that comes along the corner. Whether or not they can weather it is going to be seen. But it is a worrying time for anybody that believes in impartiality in broadcasting.
Jack, Ofcom's role isn't just about regulating broadcast news. It regulates the phone industry, radio, even the post office, and it's going to soon regulate the internet. What do you think we'd expect from a Dacre-chaired Ofcom?
Wow, heaven knows what to expect from that. I mean, I couldn't agree more with what Faraz just said, and it beggars belief that you could resubmit or reformulate an interview policy and then someone could come in and qualify. It's a bit like kind of rewriting RFPs, isn't it, to suit the vendors. What I do know is it would worry me.
Faraz, do you think, how likely is it he's going to get the job? Give me your percentage. What do you think?
Oh my God, am I now part of the betting markets?
I wouldn't
bet against it. Is my short answer. I think that because it's generated so much noise. I mean, we don't even know if he's applied for the job again. It's unclear as to whether or not he's even in the running, and he's put himself in the running to go through this process.
So he sort of left Associated properly this week, didn't he? And also, they changed the job descriptions were tweaked, and if you can read into them that he fits slightly better to the current job description than the one he failed last time.
I'd love to have job descriptions tweaked for me. That'd be nice, wouldn't it? I think they have to have like a real robust case to say this is why they're going to do it, because it is so controversial. And actually, you could probably find somebody else that has got similar political persuasions that isn't as in the public eye to take this position, and it would be much quieter and may even have the same impact. I think it's one of those things where Dacre is almost bigger than the regulator themselves, and you know, is one of these editors that kind of is such a presence and a figure that it would almost overshadow what it, the work, any work that Ofcom do moving forward, which I think is going to be problematic for them. So it seems a bit strange to me about why Dacre wants to do this, and when what's the purpose for it, other than they just want another person to bash the BBC over the head with, because he's obviously not a big fan of the BBC. It has to be said, you know, it is very easy to criticise Paul Dacre and say that he's an ogre of the broadcasting industry, and we should do everything that we can to stop him from taking the job. But the realities are, he has grown one of the most successful media brands in the country, and has pivoted it to online in a way that very few other papers have been able to do, bar maybe The Guardian. You know, the Daily Mail online is a massive juggernaut when it comes to its international presence, and you could argue that there is some validity in his experience from that point of view. He my understanding is that he oversaw it as it became such a big online brand, and so, you know, I'm sure that he has got a strong case for why he is an exceptional candidate for this sort of position, but the amount of baggage that comes with it just feels icky to me.
Also, I think he's going to be surprised on how much work he's going to have to do on broadband pricing and postal regulation as well, and that he won't just get to spend his time making it harder for the BBC to exist.
He'll have to be doing some DAB Plus stuff as well, won't he, Matt?
Yeah, all of that. If I was an Ofcom executive, I'd be piling up his in tray with incredibly boring things and see how he finds that. Flicking over to somebody who Ofcom regulate, ITV. I mean, they're in a great place at the moment with revenues up and better than pre-COVID levels. Jack, ITV's revenues is not just ad sales, is it? What else is in the mix?
There's the mix of that ad sales, I guess, as well. What's the hub revenues, but then there's also ITV Studios, which has had a kind of decent period after all production based companies have struggled during COVID and during the associated lockdowns. But yeah, they had very encouraging results. The total ad revenue was up. The digital engagement figures, that kind of all of them were up. I think kind of ITV Hub's got more users, more registered users, more people viewing. But behind that, and I haven't looked entirely at the data, but when I've looked at the data before, anytime there's a big football tournament and anytime Love Island's on, that has a big impact on the digital numbers, and both of those events have occurred in this period. So I think they kind of my view is, yes, the results are good, but actually from a digital point of view, I don't feel they're still doing enough. I don't think they're giving digital enough kind of primacy or even kind of fair weight in the same way that other European broadcasters are doing. It's tough. I mean, it's that same challenge, isn't it? While the traditional business is still delivering cash, like it's hard, but my concern would be they need to drive more usage. They need to kind of get people more addicted to the digital service. I think only kind of, they said they've got 30 odd million registered users and 9.6 million monthly average users. So my question would be kind of, what are all the other registered users doing every month? And they talked about improving the content proposition on the hub. I think they described it as extending catch up and doing more box set launches and a little something about short form. But again, I think they're behind in ambition terms of other broadcasters here. They're still letting the broadcast channels kind of lead and not giving much of an advantage or even fair win for the hub. And I think they could do more there. And that's true also for BritBox. But, I mean, they mentioned a BritBox number, which, let's be honest, was very underwhelming, even though they said, oh, we've had growth. And the fact that they are pushing the AVOD side of things, describing how Planet V kind of is working very well and that side of business is growing. It just seems to sort of those underwhelming figures for Britvox. Well, I think they're in a confused position with that, I'd put it that way.
But they've had some big hits, haven't they, for us? They've had new shows on ITV, they've had shows for Netflix, they've had shows for Apple TV+. What's doing well for them?
Yeah, I think that this hybrid model of having a broadcaster and also being a studio, which is similar to what Sky have as well, you know, they have their technology arm and they have their, you know, they have their own original content that they're making. It is a model that seems to be working across the board because you can effectively spread your bets around content. Either you make it yourself or make it for other people and you broadcast it and you stake your claim on the advertising space or you stake your claim on the SVOD space. Being in both actually feels like quite a sensible strategy for a lot of these broadcasters, and I have to say, raises questions about the future of Channel 4 and the questions around privatisation. If ITV are able to be so successful in that hybrid model, it makes the case for not privatising Channel 4 a little bit trickier, I would argue. Also, like, if I was to jump on my own train to the speculation station, I would argue that a lot of this might be to do with Apple's restrictions around cookies and mobile phone privacy data, which has had a massive impact on places like Facebook, which has, you know, gobbled up all of the advertising revenue for such a long time. If you're an advertiser now, you would probably see, and I have no, to be absolutely clear, I don't have any particular inside knowledge around this, but, you know, if I was to just look at it as an outsider, if you saw what happened where to clarify that, Apple have done this thing where you now have to opt in to allow tracking across your devices and across your different apps if you use an Apple device, which has hit Facebook's business model quite hard.
Because they use that targeting information to get better yields and better click-throughs on ads.
Exactly that. And if Apple are kind of pouring cold water on that business model, it leads to reason that the advertising dollars may flow back to the traditional advertising spots that exist on things like ITV. So this may be the beginning of a kind of re-emergence of traditional advertising, as it were. It could just be a blip because lots of people were at home and watching telly, so therefore advertising revenue became more valuable. But, you know, you're not going to advertise in cinemas, for instance. You know, no one went to cinemas last year. So it'd be interesting to see if this sustains for next year. But I think that ITV's model of having their own programming that they make for broadcasters that don't have advertising, like Apple and Netflix, and also having their own channel where they can leverage the advertising revenue is a really sensible and strong one as we continue to evolve through this market. And I do think we are now settling down into a mix of advertiser-led programming and subscription-led programming, and people like ITV are at the forefront of that.
I mean, it'd be crazy for Apple to be the saviour of TV advertising. You mentioned their Channel 4. According to The Times, they're close to securing a new multi-million pound deal for the Great British Bake Off and sort of associated spin-offs. How important is Bake Off to Channel 4?
Right now, it's essential. I mean, like, there's no bigger show. It's the real both revenue and eyeball driver for Channel 4. I don't know what the stats are. I know the launch was down quite significantly on previous years. And, you know, again, completely anecdotally, I haven't watched this season. Like, I kind of checked out after the first episode. I haven't seen as many people talking about it. There doesn't seem to be a breakthrough character like we've had in previous years. Does that mean it's going to be easier to renegotiate for Channel 4? Does that mean that it's not the prize cow that it used to be? Is all up for debate. But I do think that we are definitely in a world right now where the next hit needs to be found, because I think we've got to a point now where people have gone a bit stale on Bake Off. Oh. There you go.
Well, well, if you want some vegan tips, catch up with Bake Off on All Four, and it's Free From Week this week that's just gone up. Jack, is having that Bake Off deal going to make Channel 4 more attractive to potential commercial backers, both advertisers, but I guess even with maybe the whole of Channel 4 being up for grabs?
I'm not sure. I mean, obviously, it's a big programme for us, is right, but I think it would be a fairly narrow-minded view of anyone either buying or looking at buying or planning a sale to factor just that. But I mean, we all know the bullet points on Channel 4, its independence, its definitely unique status, and the fact that kind of selling it raises a huge challenge for the independent production industry. We've actually just, well, not long ago, we completed a survey of the production industry, sort of a COVID impact survey for PAC, the Producers Association. And we're just about to finish the export survey that we do every year for them as well. Unfortunately, it's not quite finished. I can't tell you the numbers, but the feedback from within that actually about Channel 4 was kind of the smaller indies were going to be in a lot of trouble if Channel 4 was going to be sold. I mean, and that's understating it. I mean, they were going to go bust and they'd leave the market. I think it's indisputable that it's important to the independent production industry. I think then the question is kind of what's the rationale for it? Can you sell it and put in the provisos that protect that? Then you just end up in a world of circular contradictions. That if you did, you're not going to get value for the thing. And it, kind of why are you doing it in the first place? I was sort of pleased to hear. The response to the consultation was extensive and big from lots of people, and I was pleased to almost see a breathless government thinking, well, actually, we'd better stop and think about this, but who knows what's going to happen.
I heard Rachel Johnson speak yesterday about government or her view on Nadine Dorries and government media policy. And she was saying that Nadine's interesting. No one knows quite yet whether she's just there as a placewoman to do what the Conservatives and what Boris Johnson wants. But also she said, you know, this might be the highest level she can get to in cabinet. So will she use that to do a good job and to sort of stick there for a long time and give some of her specific views? I think for us, we flick between Channel 4 saved and then suddenly Channel 4's not being saved. Go on, give me some more odds. What do you reckon next year?
How have I ended up being like the odds tracker for the media podcast? I'm like, I feel like I should be taking a bit of a cut from this.
Do you think they'll make it? Do you think they'll make it or do you think they'll be flogged off?
No, to be honest, I mean, I think to Jack's point, like, I don't want to be selfish about it, but frankly, the impact it has on other companies, this is a much bigger story than Channel 4, right? I run a small indie, and if you're going to just kind of throw this out without and ignore the whole industry kind of saying this is a terrible idea, you know, it's not Channel 4. Everybody that's an exec at Channel 4, the commissioning editors that are there, everyone that's kind of like got to the higher echelons of media, they're going to be all right. You know, some of them have already landed big jobs at places like Amazon and Disney, etc. None of that lot are going to be that worried about whether or not they're going to pay their mortgage in the next year. People like us are, right? You know, I run a small production company. Having another customer be taken off the table simply because of some weird logic around that they've kind of concocted around, you know, the future of Channel 4 is a real, real concern. There is legitimately a debate to be had around Channel 4, and it's well overdue about whether or not Channel 4 is meeting its remit. And to go back to the conversation around Bake Off, you know, Love Productions isn't a small production company, and it's part owned by Sky, if I understand, right? The people that run that company aren't going to lose sleep if Channel 4 disappears tomorrow. They'll find another buyer for their incredible slate of programming. The issue is that while Channel 4 continues to be distracted by those big deals and those big brands, which frankly have found success on other channels and they're bringing them over and shipping them over and raising the price of them, it's the smaller indies that are kind of left out in the cold. And we're the ones that are kind of, you know, championing it, kind of going, you need to save this. It's important for our business. It's really, really essential. Yes, the voices from the bigger indies have come out there as well. Frankly, though, the pressure on them is less significant. And, you know, it will be companies like ours that will go to the wall. But we haven't, if I'm being brutally honest, and it's probably a controversial thing to say in publicly, but we haven't really had a huge amount of love from Channel 4 back about whether or not this is, you know, how we are meant to be surviving this. And, you know, I would very much like to see 4 spend less time renegotiating the Great British Bake Off and spend more time celebrating the small and medium-sized indie community that's out there. That will be lost. And as a result, television creativity will be lost if this continues to go the direction it's going in.
So talking about indies, but from a slightly different angle, one story that came out of the Radio Academy Festival last week, by the way, bonus episode with one of the sessions on this podcast feed, there was some news about a new fund for emerging indies. Faraz, have you had a look at what Charlotte Moore announced last week?
Yeah, there's lots of really interesting things going on at BBC Sounds at the moment, and they seem to be like really confident in the way that they are trying to mix things up to create a whole new wealth of suppliers out there. There's the I can't remember the exact title of it, but there's a separate project that BBC Sounds are doing that's like an innovation space for people that don't work in radio at all, which looks like it's going to be quite successful, and it's got some strong ideas that's come through it as well. Kalik Mir is heading that up, and I think that is really a smart way of kind of going, well, actually audio as a medium has changed quite significantly, and we can have some new entrants come into this space and see if they can try new things up. You know, radio is, there's a very, very particular way of making radio, which meant that it was the kind of custodian of a few production companies. But I think now that podcasting and more people have got into it, you know, I'm sitting here with a little podcasting desk, and we've made podcasts for the BBC, a couple of small podcasts as well. So this sort of thing is really interesting to companies like us. You know, while there are threats in other spaces, the innovation of opening up the supplier base to smaller companies like us is super interesting, and we're certainly excited to see where it goes. And we'll certainly be putting our feather in the cap. That's not right. What is it? Our coin in the well? I don't know what the right analogy is, but you pick your right audience.
Because what she announced was a £250,000 development fund for sort of audio ideas. And I know that radio indies historically have never really had any development money. It was sort of expected that you fund the development yourself, and then you hope to get a commission later on. Whereas telly sort of had that a bit longer. I mean, development money's important for any media, isn't it, for us?
Yeah, I mean, it's essential, and that's actually one of the biggest problems that we have as a production company is trying to figure out how much of your own money and time you invest into development for an idea that, you know, that may not be in vogue by the time you get to the other end of it. And having that balanced out is essential when it comes to creativity, because you're de-risking the ideas that you can have, and therefore you can be a bit more ambitious around them. So I think it's a really great thing, and I think that development in television is very much around the idea of, let's try things out, and if they don't work, at least we've put the investment in time, effort, and frankly money to see if we can make it work. And I think that audio will end up with some better, more exciting ideas as a result of it. And you know, some of the audio work that BBC Sounds is doing, yes, some of it is bought in, like, you know, have you heard George's podcast? But it is exceptional in the way that Radio 4 was always seen, and Radio 3 for that matter, was always seen as exceptional in yesteryear. So I think that if they can be on the front foot of that, then I think all credit to them. And I think it will need development money. It can't just be the custodians of wealthy people and you know, hobbyists. It has to require a decent business plan behind it.
Jack, Charlotte Moore announced this scheme. Now, she's the first to say that she hasn't had that much experience in radio. She sort of inherited it all now as the BBC's kind of head of content. But are there any existing schemes in TV that the radio sector could learn from?
I don't know specifically, yes, but I absolutely kind of agree that with what sort of some, well, all of what Farah says, but in particular the fact that kind of TV has had support, whether it's been at the high end with the kind of tax relief that productions have had, that had a big impact on the amount of money that came into drama production, and just support from, I mean, going back to the 2003 Communication Act and how they kind of changed things around and made sure that there was investment and a thriving kind of production community, and that paid dividends because it built what is kind of one of the most kind of one of the largest, the most, I guess, creative and commercially successful kind of production sectors there is. So it probably, like Charlotte, I'm no expert on radio, but as a consumer and as a listener, I have a feeling that it's going in a nice direction and there are really interesting things happen. And I think kind of, yes, investment in this has got to be good, and there should be some real benefits to come out of it.
You're an expert on radio, Matt. What do you think?
I think it's good. I think any new money is a good thing. I think the development money and having it you know, tagged to development is definitely in demand from production companies and something they've been saying for a long time that they just don't have. And actually, the development only goes to people, you know, it's extra hours, it's extra days, freelance work. It's not making people spend time developing ideas that you then pitch to the BBC. You know, it gives them some money for that work, even if the show doesn't get commissioned. I think the other thing that's interesting that Audio UK are really pushing for is tax credits. Just pick up what you were saying there, Jack, because, you know, tax credits have delivered a lot of TV investment. And actually, UK is in a good place for audio and audio production for non-UK territories, podcasts, audiobooks, all that sort of thing. So if the government do want to build back better and such things, a small amount of money, tax credits would potentially make quite a difference.
I have no concept of the budgets with radio, to be honest. I understand budgets to TV. So what magnitude is $250,000 in development money? It's a very good proposal, but is it significant enough? Is it enough, do you think?
Well, it's more than zero, right? And I think that in development previously, there wasn't any. So, you know, the audio is both cheaper to make than TV, obviously, but also, you know, it's therefore more difficult to build a company because, you know, the revenues aren't, and the bottom lines aren't as, and the margins aren't as broad as they are in video. But one thing I think it is worth noting is that from what I've seen, again, is that, you know, we've done some audio work and I'm very passionate about audio, but it's not a world that we are completely 2 feet in. And what I've seen as an outsider is that IP in audio is becoming more and more valuable, and there are podcasts that have been turned into films. There are books that have been launched off the back of podcasts, and I think that, like, actually, let's have a little bit of cynicism around this. When you do development deals, you also then take some of the IP as a result of that as well. And I think that Charlotte's quite savvy to this, that actually, if you're running a corporation like the BBC, it's never about just one medium. If you can find, like, there's a story out today about Chris Ramsay's podcast being turned into a TV show. That's the sort of thing where I think the BBC are kind of going, well, hang on a minute. If we can do some development in audio, we may have a lot of gains when it comes to our other spaces. It's like the BBC Metaverse and the development money for the BBC Metaverse. It's all coming.
As long as Mark Zuckerberg's not there deciding what gets commissioned, I think we'll be okay. Now, speaking about investment and money, we'll be right back after this.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Oh, welcome back. Jack and Francis are still with me, and it's time for some media news in brief. The BBC have pulled out of a diversity scheme organised by the LGBTQ+ charity Stonewall. This follows a very heated social media response to a podcast series investigating Stonewall by Five Live's Stephen Nolan, and an article by BBC Nottingham, which then got some spread after being on the BBC homepage, about we're being pressured into sex by some trans women, which was positioning lesbians as being pressured into sex by trans women, which the Beeb then decided to edit. Faraz, this has all happened in the past couple of weeks. What do you make about what's been going on and the response?
Well, I think it's important to note that, you know, I'm not part of the LGBT community, and actually I'm very mindful of that, that actually these sort of decisions impact those communities and their voices, I would argue, not being heard enough. It's important to note that the BBC is a significant workplace. It's not just a place for output. And so when only these things happened, it has a very chilling effect on other communities. And I would say that, you know, this feels a little bit worrying because we've had a similar sort of story that came out around what happened with Marcus Ryder and the fact that he got overlooked for the Newsbeat job because of his campaigning work. And I think Tim Davie is very much, he's the DG of the BBC, Tim Davie has very much come out quite publicly and said that, you know, we need to do more to make sure that we are, you know, we're not being seen as taking a political stance one way or another. And there is a lot of value around that. But the problem that this is creating is communities within inside the BBC and people that may want to work for the BBC are having to kind of reconsider what they can be public about. And the biggest issue for me is that the trans community have some of the most horrific statistics around violence and suicide that is kind of almost been brushed aside in this debate about gender rights and gender identity. And that's a real, real concern, because if you're somebody working within the BBC right now, today, who is having thoughts about their gender identity, and then this news comes out and you know that your workplace is not being as supportive as it can be, that can have a real, really, really damaging effect to a level that is quite terrifying. And I think that we need to be quite careful about how this debate is being played out in public and via the news agenda, but also how it's being played out within workplaces and in people's personal lives. Because I know, you know, from what's happened with the Marcus Ryder incident, I have become more conscious about what it is that I would say and how I would say it. And I think that that's a concern. Like, you know, if I'm somebody that wants to have an opinion around diversity, but I know that that may have an impact on my future career, that changes the game. And it changes the game even more significantly from people that don't have power. And all of these decisions are being made by people that have significant power. And that's a real concern for those that are in other communities who simply don't feel like they have a voice in the first place.
And there seems to be a sort of a split with the younger employees who are maybe more used to thinking about these issues and having engaged with them than the older employees, a bit like the public at large as well. And there's a sort of who's commissioning this material versus it tends to be at the older end, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of it comes back to, like I said, about this thing in power. You know, if you've got a career and you've had a career for a number of years, then all of these things feel like they are just part of a news agenda and not part of your kind of identity. And, you know, younger people, by their very nature, are thinking about who they are and what they want to become. And all of these issues around diversity get mixed up within that. Look, there is no doubt that this issue around the trans community and transgender rights and transgender identity is becoming another part of, like I mentioned earlier, part of this kind of culture war. We've had Piers Morgan stick his toe in and, you know, say some outrageous things. It's getting clicks, it's getting newspaper headlines, it's causing, you know, people like GB News to throw their arms in the air and create programming around it. So there is a debate around that. And while I'm certainly on the sense that trans identity is not something that is part of an impartiality issue, it's true that some people identify to a different gender to the one that they were born with, and that's just a fact. And I don't understand why that isn't seen as the norm. There are people that are still going through that process. So the best way to go through that process is with debate. There's no doubt about that. That the issue I have is when we're considering it as a workplace. It then, if you're debating within a workplace, that becomes significantly disruptive and becomes a real concern to the welfare of your team.
So hot on the heels of the Rajars, which we talked about last time, TV's thinking about overhauling their ratings data. Jack, what's going on?
It seems like Groundhog Day with this. The emergence of this initiative, Origin, isn't it called? Yes, Origin, I think. It is very interesting. TV viewing or video viewing analytics, both kind of from a TV, traditional TV point of view and an online point of view, has been a sort of challenged area for years. Traditional TV measurement bodies, the TAMs, have been kind of changing and improving and innovating their products for quite a few years. But generally around improving the existing kind of approach to measurement and incrementally adding kind of bits, sort of on-demand measurements and multi-screen measurements. But there's always been, from the TAM point of view, there's always been issues with kind of the structure and the operation of those TAMs that's hindered progress, because there's always been resistance from the stakeholders, to be honest, involved in the TAMs.
And TAM is like total audience measurement.
Yeah, there's different ways they're run around the world, but in the UK, obviously we have BARB, and it's run by as a joint kind of industry committee of broadcasters. And originally they were very resistant to changing it, and as a result, the good old BARB ratings were the only currency advertisers used to accept for TV. And even as kind of TV started to fragment, maybe kind of catch up viewing and consolidated viewing, kind of it was still kind of the only currency that was accepted by the advertisers. And then they started doing initiatives, and some of our clients who are paid TV operators had their own initiatives with using the return path data from the set-top boxes that people were actually using. But you always had the problem that the flow of data was imperfect, because someone owned a high volume of better quality data. The TAMs had a smaller volume of data, but it was maybe better in quality in terms of being able to identify what type of audience it was, who they were, the demographics, and kind of where they were. But then obviously online video comes along, and you almost have two sides to it. You have the sort of the data that the big tech platforms are using for online video, and that feeds the digital video ad kind of systems and economy, and those two never have met properly, and people have had problems with comparing those two as well, saying it's you're not comparing apples for apples. So, and what I find interesting about this initiative is that it seems like it's bringing together lots of the stakeholders, the important stakeholders, so some big advertisers, some big agencies, some big publishers, and the global platforms. And their aim is to bring together the data from different sources, including BARB, including, I mean, said the Rajar, kind of the BVOD data from the broadcasters, data from the tech platforms, and they're talking about how they'll do it with some anonymized mechanism. And great. Fantastic. The system really needed improving, but let's wait and see. We're going to have to see. I have to get more detail on this initiative.
So here's something you might have missed. The editor of the Evening Standard, Emily Sheffield, has gone. The former Vogue exec was in post for about 15 months. Faraz, there was some disquiet from staff about how editors at the Standard had been hired in recent years.
I didn't even know she'd gone. That's like literally hot off the press. This is new news to me.
Kind of what's interesting is she was really hit by COVID. You know, she took over as COVID started. You know, no one was in town to pick up a Standard. They then went on to like delivering to the Standard at home. I mean, tough time to take over what's still a relatively big paper.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a shame, really. She hasn't been given plans. I mean, I can't even remember the last time I picked up an Evening Standard, because frankly, you know, commuting into town wasn't a thing anymore. So I do think it's a bit of a shame that she's not been given a chance to mould that title in her own image, as good editors should be able to do. So it's curious as to why it's happened. But in the same instance, if you came into that job pre-COVID, there's two things at play. Number one, is that newspaper going to go back to what it was post-COVID, or do you need a completely new strategy and therefore a new editor to take it into what will become the new normal, or whatever we call it now? You know, are people going to be commuting in the same way? Are we going to see as many people going into town and picking up a newspaper, or you know, are people going to be doing more days of work at home? And will that impact the free sheets in a way that they hadn't predicted before her appointment was made? So, you know, from a strategy point of view, it makes sense to completely review all of that. And if part of that review suggests that Emily's strategy was purely around the printed paper, then maybe you do need to have a look at it again. But it does seem a bit curious not to give her at least a chance before, as people start going back into town and back at their desks.
Jack, in the time that she's been the editor, and because of the challenges that she's faced, I mean, the print editions often halve to as small as 28 pages on some days. Can it bounce back as a print title, or do you think it's got to follow the Metro route, which is in a sort of similar situation, and really double down on digital?
I think maybe that's not an either or. I don't think it necessarily needs to give up on print, but it certainly needs to have a kind of a robust and strong digital strategy. There's no question. I did read this story. It sort of almost sounds like bingo calling sometimes when they talk about the amount of money the Standard loses. It is scary when you kind of read that. I think it doesn't help her, putting aside all of her own merits, that after George Osborne, you had someone who was related to David Cameron. So I think that kind of led to lots of internal, maybe cynicism by the sounds of it. I think kind of there's lots of sort of post-COVID questions we all have about how we're going to behave. But I feel like the Evening Standard will be kind of sitting on the tube seat next to you for a while to come.
I didn't realise that she was Cameron's sister-in-law. Maybe she'll make a good Ofcom chair.
Well, the Trumpocracy is strong. One thing that we don't look to the Trumpocracy for, though, is the media quiz, which is purely based on skill and your own personal integrity. This week, it's entitled Paraphrase. I guess that makes me Mr. Chips. I'll be removing squares to reveal a quote about a media story from this week. Go with it. It's going to be fine. Basically, I'll read a quote. You tell me who they're talking about. So there'll be three rounds. Buzz in with your name if you know the answer. So Faraz will say...
Faraz.
And Jack will say...
Jack.
Let's play Paraphrase. Right, number one. A hugely significant force, not just in our newsroom, but in the very fabric of British politics and broadcasting. An absolute titan. We will miss you.
Faraz, this...
For us,
this is
who is Adam, it and who
this
said
is,
it?
Adam Bolton and leaving Sky News, right?
That is correct.
He's left, hasn't he? Yeah, he's left.
He's going to leave at the end of the year. Do you want to take a guess at who said it? It's one of his colleagues.
I'm going to say Kay Burley.
It was Kay Burley, talking about Adam Bolton. And he's obviously leaving Sky News after 33 years. That's quite the time. Jack, I mean, he's been there since the very beginning. There aren't many journalists who are that loyal to a publication, are there?
No, I don't. God, yeah. I'm trying to think. There's probably some BBC lifers. But I think he's had a great innings.
There's two clips doing the rounds at the moment. One is Adam Bolton swallowing a fly, which is amazing. And the other one is David Cameron talking to a tree, of which Adam Bolton kind of kindly points out there's a whole trove of it'll be all right on the night clips from Adam Bolton that I think that we can definitely commission a Channel 5 show off the back of.
His leaving tape should be very entertaining, I imagine. Right. Number two, buzz in if you know who said this and who they're talking about. Right. The use of the term pornographer when applied to our client
Jack.
Is factually wrong. Oh, buzzing in, Jack.
Yeah, this is one of my favourite people to read about. This is good old Tricky Dicky Desmond, Richard Desmond, who amazingly, it seems, has been I think it's been well known in media circles, especially when he bought Channel 5, that he wanted to sort of whitewash his past, he's taking this to even more incredible levels by I think, is it Wikipedia? Yeah, he keeps having his Wikipedia entry changed, and he's arguing that he can't be called a pornographer.
Yes, and also I think The Guardian looked at this, and clearly somebody in his team has been trying to keep editing Wikipedia against the rules to remove this, but the Wikipedia editors are very keen to pop it back in.
Can you imagine getting a phone call from Richard Desmond's team saying, Richard Desmond would like you to make you an editor? And you're like, oh my God, amazing. I mean, the editor of one of Richard Desmond's like elite titles. It's a bit like, no, you're just the editor of his Wikipedia page.
I think my favourite Desmond story, when he moved Channel 5 in with his adult TV channels, someone one morning opened the dishwasher to get some mugs out and found a load of sex toys that had been being cleaned overnight. Right, number three, so it's one all. Final one, we'll crown the winner. Daisy, can you or your agent pick up the phone? We can't keep communicating through Carol Baskin.
Faraz.
Yes, Faraz.
This is like a really weird story about her book, right? So I'm going to say her book publisher said this.
Yes. Well, sort of.
Yeah, because so Daisy didn't say it and Carol didn't say it, so it must be her, and it's not her agent. So yeah, her book publisher is saying something about this weird thing where, like, Daisy May Cooper's paid Carol Baskin via Cameo to like say some gags to her book publisher. So sorry, I'm being very vague with this story because it's a really weird one.
Let me help you out. So Daisy May Cooper is clearly having some trouble with her publishers, or if not, at least having lots of fun with them. And so rather than speak direct, she started doing requesting cameos by Carol Baskin to give messages to her publisher. But this week, the publisher, which is Penguin, have requested their own cameo from Carol Baskin, and she has sent a message back. Let's hear Daisy's first Carol Baskin message.
Pay Daisy her money. What's the matter with you guys? Pay her what you owe her, for crying out loud. Daisy is not going to be talking to you guys anymore. She's going to go through Carol Baskin and bring the message through me to you, because you guys are asking for a Baskin by not paying Daisy what she's owed. What were you thinking?
Well done, Faraz. You are the winner of the media quiz.
Way. Do I get Carol Baskin to read out a congratulations?
Oh, we'll get someone on Cameo to send you a message.
Joe Exotic giving me a tiger.
More around the $10 to $15 mark. Well, that's our show for today. My thanks to Jack Davidson and Faraz Osman. If you've enjoyed this episode, why not bung us the price of a hot chocolate at your chalet in the Alps, or of a cameo that you might be booking for a colleague? Just head to themediapodcast.com/donate. That's themediapodcast.com/donate. If you've just listened to 50 minutes of this, maybe send us a few quid. And of course, follow us to hear new episodes when they drop on your podcast app of choice. If you haven't got one of those, just go to podfollow.com/themediapodcast, and that will direct you to a place to listen. My name is Matt Deegan. You can find my weekly newsletter about the audio industry at mattdeegan.com. The producer was Matt Hill. It was a Rethink Audio and PPM production, and we'll see you in a fortnight. Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.